Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. Today's show, we're sort of taking partly on the road, not intentionally necessarily, but there was a huge, huge accident on Highway 60, which prevented me from getting over to the station. So I'm doing it roadside with the kind production assistance of Jessica Green. So they have to bear with us. There may be a few little glitches along the way. But my guest today is Patrick Hardy, the founder of Bleep Bee Platoon, which describes itself as the first all-volunteer disaster response team that assists beekeepers, first responders, and the public when dealing with honeybee swarms, evacuating or sheltering bees, as well as transporting them to safe locations in preparation for a disaster. The Bee Platoon also assists apiaries in their disaster recovery by helping find resources and support to get their pollinators, meaning, of course, the bees, back to what they do best. Not surprisingly, perhaps, Hardy is a master beekeeper. He and fellow Bee Platoon team members make presentations to schools, government agencies, first responders, and beekeepers in order to help them manage a honeybee emergency. Bee Platoon is also active on social media, including YouTube, aiming to widely provide information on disaster preparedness for bees and beekeepers. Other Bee Platoon services include offering training to become a certified Bee Platoon disaster responder, learning the skills needed to be deployed to disaster zones around the U.S., work with beekeepers and first responders. We'll explore Bee Platoon and related realms when I speak with Patrick Hardy in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. First, a programming note. Next Wednesday, September 3rd, I'll be away, and hosting in my absence will be the fabulous Bev Capshaw. She's lined up a terrific guest, Lynn Mendelusky, whose work experience included a stint at Lowry Park Zoo. In this Talking Animals interview, Mendelusky will discuss her work as a vulture advocate, expressing her passion for and expertise about these birds of prey. Not entirely coincidentally, a few days after the interview, September 6th, is International Vulture Awareness Day, which we'll also discuss. Meanwhile, coming up later on today's show, we'll speak with Alicia Duvall, president of Docs in Adoption, Rescue and Education, or DARE, and an organizer of Rainbow Bridge Remembrance Day, happening tomorrow, Thursday, August 28th, in Clearwater at 6:30 p.m. As suggested by its name, the event aims to offer comfort for those grieving the loss of a pet. There's more to the evening, of course, and we'll hear those details from my speaker, Alicia Duvall, later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss bees, beekeepers, and the Bee Platoon with Platoon founder Patrick Hardy. With the reminder that we're going to try to take calls, I guess, or at least emails, so you can call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Patrick Hardy to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you? You're stuck in traffic today, huh?
Well, to say the least, yeah, it was like a pretty extreme version of, quite a serious crash, and it was backed up for hours, and there was just no way for me to get to the radio station today, unfortunately. But I appreciate you kind of rolling with our improvised version here, and we will get to bees in just a moment. But first, let's establish the kind of the basic Patrick Hardy story, starting with where did you grow up and what were your interests as a kid?
I grew up in a place called Mission Viejo, California. It's one of those places where it's a wonderful place to grow up, wonderful place to have a family, but it is the worst place imaginable if you ever want to be a disaster professional. I grew up there, and I went to college. I was an EMT. That was how I started my career. And I went to college, and the summer after I graduated, I was trying to figure out what to do with my life. And 20 years to the day of today, we had Hurricane Katrina. And I said, you know, there's got to be a better way of doing disaster preparedness. And so I left for New Orleans. I actually wrote a letter to the governor of Louisiana. I said, listen, you know, I'm a young professional. I want to be a disaster person, and I would love to work for you. And they called me 2 days later and said, we've never gotten a letter like that, but you can come work for us. So I ended up doing work in Louisiana, Hurricane Katrina. And I worked my way up through, I was a Fortune 500 consultant for disasters, and I work with small businesses and families. That's kind of my day job, so to speak. So, and now I work with honeybees as well.
Well, yeah, we'll definitely.
That's how it all got started.
In sex, but So that sounds like some big leaps there. So, for example, what did you study in school that sort of already made you, it sounds like back then, interested in responding to disasters and how to do a better job doing so?
Well, you know, I studied political science. That was one of the majors I had. And one of the things, for those of you who are hearing this, who were political science majors, you kind of know where I'm coming from here. Everyone who studies political science has some kind of some goal or some kind of cause in mind, something that's important to them. So they say, you know, I want to eliminate nuclear weapons, or I want to, you know, eliminate famine, or I want to have peace in the Middle East, well, whatever it happens to be. And people used to routinely ask me and say, Patrick, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. I have no idea. And so I would, but I studied international politics. I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And watching TV and seeing what happened to Hurricane Katrina, I said, wait a minute. This is the most powerful country in the history of mankind, and this is the best we can do with disaster preparedness. And I said, there's got to be a better way of doing this. And so I said, I want to study this firsthand. I want to actually go to New Orleans, and I actually want to see, because there's got to be a better way of doing this. And so I thought, if I devote my life to this, if I really focus on doing disaster preparedness and I apply a different mindset, a different way of doing things, then I bet that I could make a difference in my career. And that's what I've tried to do, which is develop new and less doom and gloom style approaches to disaster preparedness. That is really important to me, because otherwise people just get turned off from disaster preparedness. And I said, if I develop these kind of new ways of doing things, then it could really change the way that we as individuals handle the disasters, not only the big ones, but the disasters in our daily lives as well.
Well, I find that so interesting, because there were so many people, so many of us, obviously, that were watching the horrors of Katrina unfold, and maybe even a certain subset of those might even have been poli-sci majors, but did not have the same response that you did. What do you think was in your background or your history or your makeup that made you say, look at the Katrina thing, in your case, say, hey, we can do better than this, and I'm going to go figure out how?
I've always been a person that likes to challenge the zeitgeist, Duncan. So one of the things I've always felt like was, if something doesn't work, if you devote your energy to it, if you devote your work to it, it's something that could be done differently. So one of the things I mentioned a little earlier was that I was a first responder throughout college. So I was an EMT, I was a medic, so I worked on an ambulance, and I said, if I take my vocational background and then I take my academic background and I kind of merge them, this is something that could develop into an amazing career. But to go back to my childhood, I will tell you, which is for me, it's always been about trying to help people in emergency situations. I did it a number of different times. I was a lifeguard. That was my very first job. And I always really liked the concept of being able to assist people when they're in their worst spot, and being able to put them in a position where you're applying your expertise, you're able to help them whenever it's a disaster or an emergency, and then that'll put them in a better spot. So that's really the genesis of how that all came about.
And do you think then or now that part of that might be, sounds like it could be from your own sort of profile that you've just sketched here, a little bit of an adrenaline junkie?
I would say so. Whenever you work as a first responder, I think every first responder in some respect gets a bit of an adrenaline rush, and from responding to a call, especially because when I was a kid, you know, the job I really wanted to have was I wanted to be a homicide detective. That's something I thought would be really fun. And it isn't just necessarily, it wasn't because of the, you know, because I wanted to arrest criminals and things, although that would be part of it. I always thought it would be really interesting. It'd be great
Sorry
to have
that.
Every.
That's
okay. Yeah, I didn't realize that. But one of the things that I wanted was every day to be a physical challenge, every day to be an intellectual challenge, each day to face things differently. And one of the things that I did when I was got into college, I started thinking about disaster preparedness, particularly after Hurricane Katrina. I said, I also would like to be part of a discipline where I can actually move the discipline itself forward, where I can actually change the paradigm. I can actually change the way we think about these things, because that's going to make the biggest difference. Because while I enjoyed working the street, I enjoyed being on an ambulance. Eventually, I said, I actually want to change the focus. And eventually, and what's interesting is that years later, I became a paramedic instructor, and I actually got asked to write the chapters in the EMT textbook on weapons of mass destruction, on mass casualty incidents, on disasters and hazardous materials. And that was the kind of thing I was really looking for, which was a chance to give back and sort of, you know, take the things I had learned over the years and be able to improve it for the next generation of folks.
Yeah, it really sounds like, especially from what you were saying earlier about what your sort of view of poli-sci majors, including yourself, were looking to, mm-hmm. you know, do something major with that training and that degree. And it sounds like mm-hmm. you really found it when you realized, you know, hey, I can not only make a difference here in disaster response, but I can change the discipline, which is kind of a pretty significant revelation mm-hmm. to come into.
Yeah, it is. And that's the reason why I started B Platoon too, because I said, you know, I was working with the entomologists at UC Davis, which is one of the top entomology programs in the United States. And when I was going through the Master Beekeeper program, they were asking me, you know, what's going to be your capstone project? What's the big thing you want to do to help pollinators? And I instantly said, I want to create a disaster team for honeybees. And there was sort of this pause in the room. And they just said, okay, that sounds great. And they were tremendously supportive in helping me develop this, because just like everything else in my career that I've done with disaster management, I said, we can't simply have beekeepers trying to evacuate honeybees and trying to recover after disasters without some kind of help and expertise. So much like going back to my EMT days, much like going back to those days where I used to respond to 911 calls, it's like now I'm doing that on a broader level, but in this case for pollinators.
Yeah, well, it sounds like everything is kind of funneled for you, kind of funneled through the perspective of disaster response, looking to either improve an existing discipline or create a new one in the case of the bee disaster mm-hmm. response.
Absolutely. And that makes it a lot of fun, Duncan. I tell you, it's so much fun to be able to work with pollinators and to be able to develop, because actually this year I'm going to be publishing a couple of papers in some bee publications, because I developed the first official methodologies for evacuating honeybees outside, to move them in anticipation of wildfires and hurricanes. I've also developed the first techniques for being able to shelter them in place. Because right now when I've talked to apiarists and I talk to beekeepers, one of the things I discovered is that many times they just go off of raw experience. They don't necessarily do the best they can. But I said, if we standardize this and we train people on these things, then we can get an amazing predictability where we have best practices. We have something that moves the discipline forward. And I intend on evolving those strategies and techniques in every single disaster situation in which we participate, because that then we take that knowledge and we continue to improve it and build upon it so that the next beekeepers are the beneficiaries of what we learned from the previous ones.
So Patrick, maybe you could just give us an example of, especially with the growing frequency of wildfires and things that would make mm-hmm. this even more pertinent probably than when you first began. Maybe you could give us an example of what a sort of lack of protocol or a loose protocol was for rescuing bees, removing bees in the midst of an advancing wildfire, and what you said in your papers that are being published about how to better do so and how to standardize the mm-hmm. procedure.
During a Palisades fire, I visited a lot of beekeepers who, and these were what we call sideline beekeepers or hobbyist beekeepers. So for those of you who don't know, for those of the listeners who aren't aware of it, there's basically three categories of beekeepers. They're what we call commercial beekeepers, and so they're exactly what they sound like. They're professional beekeepers. They run an apiary, which an apiary is what we term a bee yard. So it's where, like, all the big white boxes you see, that's where they all are. It's where the bees live. And they are professionals every day. They're moving boxes. They're taking care of their hives. Then you have what we call sideline beekeepers, and they're like small businesses. So these are people who have day jobs or they're retired and they just they have bees on the side, so they'll have maybe five or six boxes, and they will they'll have honey, which they sell, you know, at farmers markets and things. And then you have hobbyist beekeepers who basically don't do it for a business. They have a couple hives or two, but they just basically keep bees because they enjoy it. So in those, I was talking to some sideline and hobbyist beekeepers in the Palisades, and I actually have a video I created. It's going to be going up in about a week or two on our YouTube channel of where we came back after the wildfire, after the Palisades, and you couldn't believe it, Duncan. Entire neighborhoods were like clear cut. It was like a bomb had gone off. It just completely leveled the entire neighborhood. And there were hive boxes still left behind. And so they weren't sure how to move these boxes. And so what we did was I told them some of the techniques that we had developed in order to get the bees out, and the timing, because the timing is so important when we're talking about evacuating ahead of a wildfire, ahead of a hurricane, ahead of severe weather. And I talked to them about and said, in the future, this is the kind of timing. Here's the kind of trucks we have to get prepared in advance, because these bees can't just be put in the back of a car. There's a way of doing it. And so we actually showed them how to do that, so that in the future, if they have to evacuate, they know exactly when they need to do it and how to best, what we call, pre-deploy their bees. So put them in a place where they can very rapidly be evacuated if the wildfire begins to overtake where they are.
So, and I guess an immediate question that comes to mind is, was it trial and error? Or how did you know what the best practice in that situation would be, since so far it didn't seem to exist officially in the industry?
You know, I contacted bee publications, and in the bee world, there's about three or four that are considered the standard ones. They're academic, but they are open to any kind of beekeepers who develop new kinds of techniques. And so I contacted all four, and I said, send me everything you have on bee evacuation, everything you have on bees and disasters, everything you have on how apiarists should respond to disasters. They sent me whatever they had. And these were articles from like 30 years ago. I'm not being hyperbolic about that. I mean, we would get articles from like 1991 and 1989. And I just said, there's got to be a better way.
That was ostensibly the most current thinking on the whole process.
It was. So I did that first so that I make sure I wasn't reinventing any wheels. And then I ended up taking that. I ended up talking to contemporary academics, ones who had been involved in disasters regarding honeybees. And I also just simply did it based on trial and error, because we had a number of disasters here in California. It's no secret. California gets a lot of wildfires. And we were trying them out in smaller wildfires where we were moving boxes very rapidly. I was working with a few local beekeepers saying, okay, if there's a disaster, I want to see how you would do it. And then I have some techniques I would like to try, because as a former first responder and as someone who has developed policies on evacuations for businesses all over the world, I want to kind of meld that information. So just like when you and I were talking earlier about melding that political science background and first response background, I did the same thing here. I sort of took my disaster background, working and developing policies and procedures for businesses and families and governments, and applied them to honeybees with the best practices that existed at the time. And so the ones that we're going to be coming out with, the articles will be published early next year. We are tremendously excited about them. They got through peer review, so it's going to be fantastic. And then once they come out, we'll have basically brand new procedures for being able to move bees and best practices, which we can build on over time.
So it sounds like, I'm curious, so do you feel like, obviously you've had a longstanding interest in disaster response and different ways to try to hone or improve those procedures. Do you find that over time, like with the bee thing you just described and some of the things you mentioned previously, that you have like a talent for like just seeing an area of disaster response that maybe hasn't been as refined, and just coming up with, because of your passion, and I guess maybe like what I'm suggesting, maybe a gift that you have for improving and solving any kind of quandaries that are previously unsolved until you've gotten there?
My mom says that's my superpower. One of the things I did.
Well, mom was, know best, that's for sure.
She does. She absolutely does. And one of the things that happened was that in my career, what I did was I worked for the government for a while, and then I worked with Fortune 500 companies, and I decided at one point that I was going to start working with small businesses because I said, wait a minute. Nobody is working with small businesses. Nobody is focusing their expertise on small companies. And so what I decided to do is I completely 180 turn around from my career focusing on big companies and governments, and I changed it to focusing specifically on small companies. And so the reason why I bring that up is because I ended up doing disaster plans for restaurants and bars and nursing homes and alligator farms and hair salons in Zimbabwe, all kinds of fascinating businesses in fascinating geopolitical environments. And I said, this is so much more fun than working with big companies. I mean, because it's just, you get to create these unique solutions that no one's developed before. So I would go to a business and I would develop techniques for disaster recovery for companies that there hadn't been any before. So for example, in California, I do a lot of the outdoor hospitality properties here. And by outdoor hospitality, I mean RV parks and campgrounds. And I was developing brand new techniques, brand new kinds of disaster programs for them, implementing new kinds of equipment, new solutions, instead of just having that boring old red binder that nobody cares about, that dusty binder that sits in the corner that no one talks about. It's like a black sheep uncle. And I said, we're going to bring an energetic approach. So the trainings I would do would be really interesting. I would get people engaged. We would have fun drills. We'd be running around. And that to me was a lot of fun. And for me to be able to, again, like I was mentioning, moving the discipline forward, because I would turn to my colleagues and I would say, the way we do things with big business, that doesn't work with small companies. And one of the kinds of businesses I worked with were apiaries. And I was working with beekeepers, and I was developing techniques for being able to do disaster recovery for apiaries. And I said, there's got to be a way to help our pollinators. And that was the way I decided to focus on it, because that's just so much fun. Just like I was mentioning earlier, finding ways, unique ways of, with unique challenges within what we're doing here to push it forward, so that it forces me to think. It's not doing the same thing day after day after day after day. And it's a very unique approach, and I really love it. I really do enjoy it very much.
Well, I want to go back to a couple of things. One thing first, though, can you give an example of, in the so-called outdoor hospitality realm, like some mm-hmm. plans or disaster response approaches that you devised that have made a difference in that realm? Because, you know, RV parks and campgrounds obviously are a pretty significant area to be in.
I work with a property, an RV park. Actually, it's technically a campground, but they do have RV park. They do have an RV park there, but it's basically a campground. And the campground is bisected in the middle with a river, and so that's fine. There's a little bridge where you can go across. But they mentioned to me when they first hired me, they said, listen, like, you know, there are times when there's flooding and then the bridge becomes totally impassable. And so how do we get people? How do we evacuate people off site? So I developed techniques for being able to get across the river. So we would pre-deploy little inflatables to be able to get people as a worst case scenario off the site. Now, one of the things we did, of course, was I said, one of the things we're going to do differently for you, differently than we would do maybe on other properties, is if we think there's going to be an approaching storm, if we think there's going to be approaching severe weather, then we're going to activate you earlier. Okay, so we're going to evacuate people across the bridge earlier than I would with another equivalent property. But we're also going to deploy inflatable rafts so that in case people absolutely positively cannot get across, we have a way of doing that. And not only that, we actually determined a place downriver where we could actually evacuate them off property. So if they were going, if they got on the inflatable, if they were on the raft, we actually got them and found a way to get them all the way across. So it isn't like a Disney ride. So that it was a simple way of being able to get across if they absolutely positively had to do it, because you never want to be caught in a situation where you can't evacuate and you can't move across the property. So that's one. Another property, which I think would be interesting to you too, is I work with a glamping property, and you're going to think I'm making this up. Totally true. Okay, so where you do your check-in, okay, so where you check into this campground, to get to your campground site, you have to take an airplane. They literally have a Cessna 401, and you check in, and then the person who checks you in loads you on an airplane, and they fly you to your site and drop you off, and they pick you up in 3 or 4 days. So we had to develop evacuation techniques of what do we do if the airplane isn't available? How are we going to evacuate people rapidly? So these are the really fun challenges in outdoor hospitality, because obviously you're not only dealing with the regular disaster elements, but also you're dealing with actually being outside, which creates a unique challenge in and of itself.
Yeah, well, that, you know, when you're checking in and being flown to your campsite, that sounds like a very specific and very remote location, but sounds interesting for sure. So are there times when things you're either working on or just things you're observing out of ongoing professional curiosity where things are just too extreme or harsh for there to be an actual effective disaster response team? I mean, like, I'm curious, like, what you thought as you were talking about some of these campgrounds and related areas, what you thought about some of the flooding that happened a few months back, which was obviously devastating. And I wonder if you thought, well, that could have been improved by this, or sometimes things are so severe in terms of the weather elements, climate change brought, whatever the cause might be, that there's just not a plan that would have been effective in that case.
What I tell my clients all the time, and what I tell audiences, I speak all over the world on disaster planning. One of the things I tell audiences, I don't care if they're in Europe, America, South America, Asia, doesn't matter. I always say this. Disasters don't just happen. Okay, they're a chain of critical events, human events. And so disasters occur when a natural event intersects with human organization. Okay, so one of the things I say to audiences all the time is I always joke around with them, and I always say, how many of you think that a Category 5 hurricane is a disaster? How many of you think it's a Cat 5 hurricane, total disaster? And I always get everybody's hands raised. And I go, it's not. What if that hurricane struck the forest and there wasn't anyone around? There was no homes, there was no nothing. Do you still consider that a disaster? And all of a sudden people go, you know, no, of course not. And so I say, the reason why disasters occur is because we haven't applied the most efficient human organization to deal with that natural event. And what happened in Texas is incredibly sad for a number of reasons. First of all, we don't know all the information quite yet. The report should be coming out before Christmas, from what I understand. I've spoken to Emergency Management in Texas, and I have a feeling that we should get the report before then. But from what we know thus far, the issue becomes notification early and being able to understand the warning signs. One of the things I do when I talk with campgrounds is I say to them, we have to have a number of different ways for you to get alerts, because you're in the middle of nowhere and there may not be cell phone coverage out here. I can't tell you the number of times. I was actually in a place called Yosemite here in California. I'm sure many of your listeners have been out here before. I don't know if you have, but I work at a campground out there and there is no cell phone coverage. Zero. When I say zero, I'll tell you this. This actually is really true. When you drive to this campground, okay, there is a white line that has been painted in the street. There's a white line. And that white line, you wonder what it's for. You find out when you drive through it. As soon as you pass that white line, your phone goes completely dead. There is no cell phone coverage whatsoever. They figured it out down to the foot as to where you can drive past. So one of the things I did with them was I said, we're going to rely on walkie-talkies. We're going to rely on weather radios and backups. And we're going to rely on, you know, hardline phones, because there just isn't a way of communicating. And so one of the things, I don't think there's any disaster that is too extreme, But what it does require more, it requires us in our human organization to be more efficient in responding to it. Maybe we need to be faster. Maybe we need to apply a better technology to it. Maybe we need to apply better backups. Whatever we have to do, those redundancies are key, because I tell people this, you don't ever have to experience a disaster. You never have to experience one. The question is are you willing to prepare for it? So if you prepare for it, disasters are largely avoidable, because what I say the definition I have for disasters is, did this make you weaker? Did this disaster, did this event make you weaker or stronger? And if you were able to get through it and you were able to make yourself stronger, then it really wasn't a disaster. It was an opportunity for you to get better and stronger each and every time.
I want to let folks know who might have been tuning in a bit late, not you know, sort of came in the conversation partway through. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. We did just tune in a bit ago. My guest is Patrick Hardy, a master beekeeper and the founder of Bee Platoon, which described itself as the first all-volunteer disaster response team that assists beekeepers, first responders, and the public when dealing with honeybee swarms, et cetera. But we're also talking more broadly, of course, about disaster response, which Patrick has a background in, and I think probably a gift for. So if you'd like to ask Patrick a question, we could probably try to take that call at 813-239-9663. Or more readily, if you want to email dj@wmf.org or text 813-433-0885, we can include you in the conversation. So, Patrick, I want to circle back. There's some other things I want to get to, but I kind of want to circle back. Ostensibly, this conversation was going to be chiefly about bees. I think we got so excited about something, or at least I did, we kind of skipped over some key elements of that story. So when did you first become interested in bees themselves?
I became interested in bees about 15 years ago when I read a book that was written by a gentleman from Princeton University. He's an expert in honeybee organizations. So honeybees have a particular organizational style. They're eusocial, eusocial meaning they rely on each other. They're a community. They have a division of labor. So they have, you know, worker bees that do this, and they have drones that do this, and the queen that does this, and they don't change roles. They all have their roles, the things they do. They have scout bees, they have morgue bees, they have all kinds of bees. And I read that because I was interested, strangely enough, in, I've always loved this idea of how human political organization, what it can learn from the natural environment and the way the natural environment organizes itself. What kind of lessons can we learn? And the book's thesis was about essentially about how honeybees, how they are able to recover when something happens to it. So how that division of labor ensures that the hive acts like its own community. It's like its own city. And I immediately thought, that is so fascinating. I would love to learn more about bees. I contacted a local beekeeper in my area. Back then, I lived in a place called Lompoc, California. For those of you who don't know where Lompoc is, it's near Vandenberg Air Force Base. And Vandenberg is in the news quite a bit because that's where SpaceX is. And SpaceX launches from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And so one of the beekeepers and I, we became friends, and he said, listen, you seem to like a lot about bees. I'm going to train you how to respond to swarms. So swarms are, of course, when a hive decides to split. So you have a certain number of bees, and they decide to take the queen, and they decide that, you know, the hive's gotten too large, or there's something's happened, and they decide to split, and that swarm will fly somewhere. And unfortunately, it doesn't care where it goes. So sometimes it goes into people's homes, it goes into their attics, it goes into offices, it goes into cars. And so they call out swarm responders in order to safely relocate that swarm. So he was doing work with Vandenberg Air Force Base and with some of the surrounding businesses in the area and the residents. And what ended up happening was Santa Barbara Vector Control put me on a list, and all of a sudden I was responding to swarms all the time. So I was working during the day, and then at night I would get calls, hey, listen, will you go to this person's house and help them to remove a swarm? And I'd say, sure. Or the base would call and say, listen, can you go down to the firing range because we have like a, there was like a shed there, and they would say, hey, can you go in there? There's a big swarm in there. And I'd say, sure. And so I would go in there, and I ended up doing that. And I worked with tons and tons of swarms. And it just suddenly occurred to me one day that I was like, I want to get a more official education on honeybees versus just what I'm learning here from, you know, being out there and putting on the bee suit and interacting with swarms is all great. But I actually would like to go and learn more about them. So I enrolled in the Master Beekeeper program at the University of California at Davis. And I actually got didactic instruction, meaning like classroom instruction. And I went through their program, and there's a series of tests you have to take as exams. Some of them are written exams. So some of them are a battery of what we call kinesthetic examinations. So learning by doing, you actually have to do certain things and put it on camera. And I learned a lot about bee organization, and I learned a lot about how it is that that our pollinators can be more efficient with the assistance of people. And so that's why I thought that symbiosis, that relationship between humans and bees needs to be nurtured and protected. And the way that I know best to do that, the way that I can best improve that, was creating a beekeeping team. Because to complete the program, you have to do a capstone project. And my capstone project was developing a disaster honeybee team. And so I developed Bee Platoon.
Why am I not surprised, Patrick, that was your capstone project?
Well, it's just, you know, I'm just one of those creative thinkers where I'm always like saying, how can I best be prepared for this? You know what I mean? Because I just find I just find honeybees to be great disaster responders. And I said, how can we work better together? And that's really how this whole thing came up. And as I said, I told you the story already about when I pitched it to the committee. And they just paused for a moment and said, that sounds like an amazing idea. And so we put it together. I'm now partnered with the California Master Beekeeper Program. I'm partnered with a number of organizations. I'm actually coming down to Florida. I'll be speaking at the University of Florida because they also have a great entomology program. And I'm developing volunteers around the country. So we have about 1,000 volunteers now. We've been open for – we just passed our first anniversary. And we now have about 1,000 volunteers. And I'm developing captains throughout the country so we can have disaster responders whenever a disaster strikes.
Well, that's a lot of volunteers in 1 year's time. That seems impressive.
Well, the Palisades fire, when we responded to the Palisades fire, it gave me an opportunity to really interact with beekeepers and show people the efficacy of a team like this. And so we had enough people who reached out and said, I'd love to be part of this as well. We had so many volunteers. I said, listen, we would like to eventually pre-deploy you so that if there's a wildfire in your area, that we actually can just call you out. And so I got people from San Diego, from LA, and just fully started moving north. And then other states found out about us. I'd be speaking somewhere or doing an interview, kind of like I'm doing today. And then people would say, listen, you know, we would love to participate as well. And I welcome all of it. So that's one of the reasons why we're standardizing the training program, because I want everyone to learn how to really efficiently evacuate bees. Because once we have standardized that, then that will be the gold standard. That's really our hope, is that this will become the gold standard. So when people say, when we talk about honeybees and dealing with disasters, these people, Bee Platoon and Patrick, are the ones who we call, because him and his team, they are the experts in this. So, and government agencies have openly embraced us. They've all said, please help us out. So right now we're working on partnerships with Santa Barbara County, Orange County in Florida, actually. So we've been doing a lot of outreach. So it's been very exciting, very exciting.
That's really great. Well, we're sort of nearing the end of our time together here, Patrick, but I'm curious, for people who may not fully realize the depth of this, why are bees important? What are their functions that they serve that people may not fully appreciate necessarily, especially if they're trying to get away from one that might sting them?
Well, I think a lot of people understand their use as basic pollinators, but here's something I don't think people really realize a lot of. That if you ever come out to California or you go into any agricultural area, particularly where there are crops that require to have pollinators, you'll be driving down the freeway. So, for example, in California, if you're driving from, say, L.A. to Sacramento, if you drive up either using this, there's basically two freeways to do that, the 99 or the 5. It doesn't matter. You take either one of those freeways, as you're driving up, you will notice white boxes on the side of the road. And those are honeybees, of course. But what a lot of people don't realize is California rents bees from other states. We actually rent bees from Louisiana. So I actually work with a commercial beekeeper in Louisiana. He literally, there's a month in the year. I can't recall the month right now. But he puts all of the bees into this 18-wheeler. He rents an 18-wheeler. He throws all the bees in there, and he sends them west. And the bees come to California, and they actually pollinate. They actually will put them on farms and near agricultural areas. And the bees will be let loose so that they can actually pollinate, because you can't have almonds without bees. There are so many crops I can think of, right off the top of my head, that if you don't have honeybees, they basically, you won't have a crop. And so being able to rent bees is so important. So when I talk to people in other states and I say, your bees are so important, and they go, well, I mean, it's really great to have my bees. I say, well, it's really important because California needs your bees. So we borrow your bees. We rent them out. And so that really helps build the crop, helps us, because there's so many areas of California that are like the breadbaskets of the state. Near Sacramento County is one. Santa Barbara County is the other one. Riverside, San Bernardino, and they absolutely have to have bees in order to be effective. And that's the reason why our pollinators from other states. So when I talk to other states, I'm actually going to be speaking in South Carolina in about a month or so, and I'm going to be telling them, your bees are just as important as any other ones. And that's why our pollinators are so important to ensuring our ecological future here in the United States and around the world.
Well, I think that perfectly answers my question. That puts us just about at the end of our time. But I've been speaking with Patrick Hardy, and we talked about a number of things, obviously, but we were originally in the core conversation was about Bee Platoon. You can check out more information about that and how you can get involved and other elements that we can get a chance to touch on by going to beeplatoon.com. So, Patrick, thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals, and thanks for all your good work.
Thank you, Duncan, for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Me too. In a moment, we'll speak to Alicia Duval, one of the organizers of Rainbow Ridge Remembrance Day, happening at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday, August 28th in Clearwater, an event geared to offer comfort for those grieving the loss of a pet. We'll hear specifics in just a moment on Talking Animals on WNF. Right now, though, originally I had a customized bee comedy piece, but we'll sort of hear that another time, and maybe we have a brief animal song we can hear in the meantime while we connect with Alicia.
I am here.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. That was, kind of snuck up on me. That's great. We're sort of improvising with my show on the road, literally here, so I appreciate that. So, great. Well, so let's start off. Many people probably know you best as president of DARE. Maybe talk about that acronym and what DARE does.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Duncan. I really appreciate it. So I am no worries at all. So my name is Alicia Duval, and I am president of DARE, which is Dachshund Adoption, Rescue, and Education. And we're a Florida-based rescue. We're only in the state of Florida. We don't have a physical shelter. We're run exclusively out of foster homes. And we're a all-volunteer run 501c3 organization. And we have been around since 2003. So we've been around a long time.
That's great. Yeah, no, for sure. Doing great work during that time, for sure. So tell me about Rainbow Bridge Remembrance Day. How did it get started?
So the origins of Rainbow Bridge Remembrance Day, I'm sure, came about. They wanted to create a national day. I will say that I have been in rescue for over 16 years now. I never thought to look up Rainbow Bridge Day. I didn't know when it was. Is considering all the animals that I have had in and out of my home and in the rescue, it was just not something on the forefront of my brain. Earlier this year, on March 18th, the day after St. Patty's Day, I lost my heart dog. My reason for living, my reason for being in the rescue. His name was Forrest Gump. And I found out later that August 28th was National Rainbow Bridge Remembrance Day. Now, this is significant, Duncan, because I rescued Forrest Gump from the Hillsborough County, back at the time it was called the Pound, on August 28th, 2009.
Wow.
So here I am. I've lost my boy in March. I am really in the grips of despair. I'm trying to figure out how to go on. Do I even want to still do this anymore? This is the most painful grief I've ever felt in my entire life. And then when I realized that Rainbow Bridge Remembrance Day was the same day as his Gotcha Day, it kind of gave me a little focus. I said, you know what? I'm going through this torture in my soul right now. I mean, I just lost him in March. And I just felt so not understood. I have a great family. I have a great support system, all the rescue people. But to people who have never lost what I like to call your heart dog, they do not understand that grief. And then a lot of times people can minimize it. I lost Forrest in March. My birthday's in April. By the time I saw a few people at my birthday, they said, are you over the loss of Forrest? I know that hit you really hard. And I just felt like, oh my God, you guys don't even understand this. So
yeah.
In doing that, I reached out to one of our partners, our sponsor company, which is the New Barker. And I started talking with Anna Cook about it. And I said, I have this idea. And I think that this is what I want to do. I found an artist on social media who I was kind of just chatting online with people. And I said, you know, I just don't feel understood in this grief. And one of the commenters said, you need to hear this song called Give a Girl by this artist, Brittany Moore. And I said, okay, I'll check it out. And later on, I found the song, and the song spoke to me. Duncan, it is the most perfect song for anyone who has ever, ever, ever loved a dog. You understand the entire compass in this song. And I felt immediately I was connected to the artist. So then I started looking at iTunes, finding all the songs she's ever released. And then I started following her on social media. And so she announced that she was doing house shows. And that's when, you know, I got with Anna again. I said, I think this is what we need to do. We need to have an evening where people who are struggling, or they just want to remember their dog and they don't want to feel weird, they don't want to feel ostracized because, quote unquote, it's just a dog or it's just a pet. And so the idea kind of bloomed from that. It was very organic. So bottom line is, I am so excited about this event tomorrow. It is, for me, it's kind of a full circle moment because it's his Gotcha Day. So this is his first heavenly birthday and he's not here, but it's also Rainbow Bridge Day. And the outpouring of support has been phenomenal. I want to let all your listeners know this is a totally free event. This is my gift to the community. I have booked and paid for the artist. We've flown her in. I took her up tonight, and I believe that this is going to be very healing for anyone in attendance. We have lighted luminaries. I have all the supplies. Everyone can enjoy their meal. Quaker Steak and Lube is hosting us. We are so grateful for them for hosting us. And it'll just be a time. If you want to talk with other people, they can come in and talk with us. If they don't, if they just want to kind of be there by themselves, maybe they're afraid to share grief or they just don't know anybody, they don't have to talk. But know that tomorrow, Thursday night, your people will be at this location, Quaker Steak and Lube in Clearwater. We will all be celebrating the love that we have for our animals, which truly, as a fellow pet lover, you understand it's a bond that's just hard to describe to someone who's never felt the bond. It's so hard to describe, but it's so powerful. And I really feel like this is such a good way for people. We have to normalize this. We will have support services on site. There will be, we'll have some people there that do counseling, who specialize in pet loss. There's all kinds of support services that we'll have there. It's just for people's benefit. We want them to know that you are not alone. I'm still in my grief walk with Forrest, but in some way, shape, and form, this feels very healing for me as well. I know that I'll be surrounded by people tomorrow night who understand what I'm going through and I understand what they're going through. And so it's not going to be weird. It's going to be a good evening with great music and just like-minded people who are okay loving their pets out loud, so to speak.
Sounds great. Well, Alicia, we're just about out of time. So very quickly, if someone's hearing this or wants to get involved or sign up or whatever, how would they do that just in a few seconds, please?
They can go directly to thenewbarker.com, and the link is right on the front page. And again, the event is totally free.
Okay. Well, great. Well, congratulations. What a great idea and what a great way to deal with your loss. I'm so sorry for the loss of Forrest.
And, thank you so much, Duncan.
Animals.
Of course. Right, have a great day. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So coming up on WNF is The Conversation, the great show hosted by Martin Meyer Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that is The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Vall, 1 to 3, followed by Doug Renks in for Nancy C, hosting a traffic jam, and more great stuff after that on 88.5 FM WNF Tampa. Thanks for rolling with us with our kind of crazy on-the-road show today. And a huge thanks to Jessica Green for all the production help. We'll see you next week with Doug Capshaw hosting. Must be an animal.